BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. Here's round one, which tries to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is the meaning of patronymic? P-A-T-R-O-N-Y-M-I-C, patronymic.
Oh, it's a Greek word. It means your father's name, your family name, coming through.
To?
Coming through to the son.
Mm. That's right, 2 marks. Something derived from a father or an ancestor. Well, it's very common in Wales too, isn't it? Same sort of thing.
Oh, son of... Oh, it's Lancashire. Tom of Bob Carter, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
It means
yes.
Tom, who is the son of Bob the Carter.
That's it. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a burbot? B-U-R-B-O-T.
B-U-R-B-O-T.
It's a noun.
Yes.
Six letters.
Yes.
Lots of people don't realise that fish hiccup.
Yes, it's getting near it.
And it... and in fact, you know, sort of goldfish hiccups, the bubbles are collected to make spirit levels. When a turbot burps, then you've got a super little bubble that's called a burbot.
1 out of 2 for this.
Wasn't that near, was it?
But it's fishy connections. A burbot is an eel-like, flat-headed, bearded, freshwater fish, and it comes from a French word meaning a fish which sort of ploughs and wallows in the mud. Dennis Powell, quite different. The meaning of the word fugacious, F-U-G-A-C-I-O-U-S, fugacious.
Fleeting.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You'll get 2 marks straight away. Fleeting. Fugacious means fleeting, evanescent, hard to capture, hard to keep. Dennis Norden, what is an afterpiece? Just after and piece put together. Afterpiece.
Well, I'm going to make a great leap of deductive reasoning here. And I believe it's a piece that comes after.
Sort of
for example,
epilogue.
No, it's like when a chicken goes over a fence, the parson's nose is the afterpiece. In that connection. It's something that's stuck on the end of something.
It's used in a particular context, this one, Dennis. In fact, a context very like where we're sitting now.
Well, it's a piece that's played at the end of the main production in a theatre.
Right. An afterpiece is a farce or a small entertainment after the main play. They don't do it often these days. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the 2 women members of the team, I hope, will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "He shall have a noble memory." And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, "Has anybody here seen Kelly? K-E-L-L-Y. And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Now we have a round of verse and poetry, and I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with the next line or two. 2 marks if they can finish the quotation, and 2 marks for saying which work and author it comes from. Beginning with Anne Scott James. "Alas, regardless of their doom, the little victims play. No sense have they of ills to come."
It's
a dreadful day.
No, it's written by Thomas Gray.
Yes, that's right.
It's that thing about Eton College.
Yes.
It is their little day.
"Ode on a distant prospect of Eton College" by Thomas Gray. "And asked, regardless of their doom, the little victims play, no sense of their ills to come, nor care beyond today." 3.5, I think, would be fairer, because you've very nearly got there. Now, Frank Muir. "The wife around her husband throws her arms and begs his stay. My dear, it rains and hails and snows."
For 'tis Midsummer Day.
It's almost your favourite author, Frank. In the 18th century.
Your favourite one's Johnson.
Favourite character? It's not Johnson.
It isn't Johnson.
No, another one.
Eight goals.
Fielding, he's yes. talking about.
Yes.
Fielding. This will be from one of his plays.
Yes, it is.
It'll be one of those interpolated ballads.
Yes.
Like Hearts of Oak.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I can't help you, Jack. You just have to work it out yourself.
One and a half for getting as far as he could on there. It's Henry Fielding's song, A Hunting We Will Go. The wife around her husband throws her arms and begs his stay. My dear, it rains and hails and snows. You will not hunt today, but hunting we will go. And it comes in a play of his called Don Quixote in England. Now, Dulles Powell, full well they laughed with counterfeited glee at all his jokes, for many a joke had he, full well the busy whisper circling round.
I know him.
You know? Oh, Frank, you know everything. That
wise man here and stern to view.
That's it.
It's rather... had rather large behind. It's the schoolmaster.
In?
The counterfeited jokes. The deserted village.
Yes.
By Oliver Wendell Goldsmith.
Oh, well gifted.
Well, you can't do the last line.
No.
Three and a half again, because you know nearly all of it. It's Oliver Goldsmith's deserted village. He's talking about the village schoolmaster. Full well they laughed with counterfeited glee at all his jokes, for many a joke had he. Full well the busy whisper circling round conveyed the dismal tidings when he frowned. Now, Dennis Norden, and I apologise in advance for my accent.
It's Scottish.
Yes,
it's Scottish. Robert Burns. Written by Robert Burns.
Dennis knows this. Hull by my Callaherin, their bonny fish and halesome fairin.
Well, that's a song.
Yep.
Hull by my Callaherin, their bonny fish and halesome fairin. Hull by my Callaherin.
That's a song.
Glasgow belongs to me. And so on. Well, it's an old Scottish song.
Yes.
Yes. Well, there should be a finality in that, yes, Jack.
Well, I wanted the fourth line because that's.
Well, I don't know. I just go dee dee da dee da generally. I don't know.
Hull by my Callaherin, their bonny fish and halesome fairin, by my Callaherin, new drawn frae the Forth. And the Forth, as far as I know, is a Scottish river. And it's Callaherin, the song by Lady Nairn, and written about 1840 or thereabouts. Calla means fresh, means they're not actually stinking herring.
I thought it was about 7:10, actually.
On our round of origins and derivations, 3 marks if members of the team can define, first of all, the present meaning, and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. N. Scott James, in borrowed plumes.
Well, it pretty well means... literally what it says, isn't it? It means in somebody else's clothes, which you've dressed up all fine and smart.
Yes, it can be metaphorical. But, all right, what's it come from?
Bird life.
Yes. With some particular bit of bird life.
Aesop, I should think.
Yes.
There was a crane and a robin, and they went to a party together, and the crane was looking absolutely marvellous and glorious, shimmering.
No, I was going to do it the other way around.
Oh, you do it then.
But the crane borrowed the robin and wore it as a mini plume.
And the moral of that is...
Yes, wear your own feathers, whatever type of bird you are.
Yes, because it didn't cover enough of the crane when he'd borrowed the robin's feathers.
It's a lovely story. I wish Aesop knew it. Borrowed plumes, in borrowed plumes, means merit you've assumed, putting on airs and graces that you haven't deserved. But it was Aesop's fable of the jackdaw who dressed himself up as a peacock in a peacock's feathers and tried to pass himself off as one, and it wasn't at all good. Frank Muir, necking.
Yes. What does it mean?
What's it mean and what's it come from?
It means a fairly restrained sort of physical flirtation.
Yes.
And it comes from America.
It does?
It's an American expression, used among the young people, or was. They didn't invent the process, they just invented the name for it. I suppose it's a fairly restricted form of dalliance, physical dalliance. And it's probably so named because that was as far south as the chap was allowed to proceed. Wouldn't you say?
Two out of three before you go any further, I think. Everyday phrase meaning mildly amorous behaviour between male and female or thereabouts. Probably it refers to the western states where when you had a restless or a wild animal and couldn't manage him or her, you tied it by the neck to a very much tamer animal, and that was the practice of necking. The idea being that the more necking, the more docile.
That's why the girl says it's neck or nothing.
And now to this power. Diplomat.
Diplomat?
Mm.
It means now a character who is asked to make the other side believe something which is not true as a rule.
He lies abroad for his country, I think.
Yes, exactly. He's an ambassador or something of the sort.
But how does it come to mean that?
Means that he has two voices or two something. Die.
It's a double is but this is a bit confusing.
Double.
You've got the right Greek root, as it were.
Anything to do with diploma?
Yes.
To check the diploma.
You get the diploma before tea.
What's he want his diploma for?
Yeah.
Ah, that's asking, Jack.
Language.
All right, two out of three. We've got a long way towards it. Diplomat is a man who manages or has skill in managing international relationships, or in a general sense, a chap who's good at handling issues or people with kid gloves. But it does come from the word diploma, which means a folded parchment. And diploma used to be written on parchment and then sealed and folded, or folded and sealed. And it meant that you had a license to practice something. It might be medicine, it might be surgery, or it might be a post in the church. But most important, it wasn't any good going abroad as a diplomat because you would have been beheaded unless you carried with you this diploma saying that you were properly accredited to the country that you said you'd come from. So a diplomat comes from the diploma that he had. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is a King Charles's head?
King Charles's head is a sort of hobby horse, the bee in the bonnet.
Yes.
And it comes from Dickens.
Dickens is Betsy Trotwood's brother, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What was his name? Uncle Dick or something?
Yes.
Was it Uncle Dick?
Dick. Mr. Dick.
Just leave it at Uncle Dick. Yes, it was from Dickens.
When he kept bringing King Charles's head into all his conversations, didn't he?
Yeah. Yes, I think that's good enough. It isn't absolutely dead right, but near enough. 3.
Nothing is absolutely
It's a King Charles's head is an obsession or a fixed fancy, and Mr. Dick was a harmless and simpleton of a character in David Copperfield of Dickens, and whatever he wrote about or said, he always got round to this subject of King Charles's head because he was composing a memorial and he couldn't get this out of his head, whatever he was doing. He was trying to write about it. That's the only difference. 3 marks. And now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, "He shall have a noble memory"?
Well, I think it's Shakespeare.
Yes.
And at a wild guess, I think it was Julius Caesar.
In the right period, and the wrong play.
And leaves Coriolanus, but it's never saying I thought it was
Stick
that.
To that. It's the last line of Shakespeare's Coriolanus, and spoken, I think, by a character called Tullus Aufidius. Now, Dennis Powell, I'd like the origin of your quotation. Has anybody here seen Kelly? K-E-L-L-Y. And it's no good telling me it's spoken by Tullus Aufidius, because it isn't.
Tell him, Dennis. Put him out of his misery.
Popular song.
Yes. It's impossible, I think, to know who wrote it.
Impossible for me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No,
all right, the music was written by a chap called C.W. Murphy, and the words were by Will Letters. There's something in about the Jolly Bachelors, but whether these were the chaps who sang it or whether it was a play, no doubt listeners will write in and tell me, because I don't know. Well, now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, "He shall have a noble memory."
There are many significant things in life which are denied to any man who elects to remain a bachelor. One of the most profound is the experience of sitting for 2¾ hours at a children's dancing school concert. I went through this numbing ordeal last Christmas. My daughter, who was 7 at the time, got involved with this dancing school because she was mixed up with a fella who's 10. When I say mixed up, I think she was mistaken for him. They were engaged. It was madness, of course, you know. And I said, you know, wait a few years till you're 12, or, you know. What had happened was this boy went to this dancing school. And so, of course, my daughter had to go too. So I took her along to the principal, Madame Estralita Lamar. I didn't believe it either, particularly as her husband's name was Ornstein. And Madame Estralita gave her a workout and came back and said, "You've made a very wise decision, Mr. Norden. Your daughter is a natural mover." You know, so the other children were battery operated or something. So anyway, she joined. And it was 7 or 6 a lesson twice a week for months, you know. And came Christmas, tra-la, a big display, a musical extravaganza of song and dance, Santa Claus's workshop. The daughter coming home and saying, "Oh, Daddy, Daddy, Madame Estralita has said I can be a snowball. Everybody must come along and clap me." Everybody turned out to be me. You know, this Frenchman who said hell is other people. It isn't. It's other people's children. There were 67 of them, all sort of smothered in lipstick and makeup, and they looked like kind of depraved midgets. And all the other parents sitting around cooing, you know. And I sat through hours of these talentless pixies and gnomes and elves, and I thought, well, I'll do the decent thing. When my daughter comes on, being myself, as it were, connected with the business, you know, I will give her a real show business reception. So as soon as that snowball came on, staggered on, I jumped to my feet and I shouted out, "This is it! Great! Look at that kid! Look at that great kid! Wow! More! More!" Everybody turned round. And the child broke into terrified tears. It was only then that I remembered there were 24 snowballs in this glittery production. And of course I'd chosen the wrong one. This was borne in upon me by the father of this child, who assumed I was taking the mickey, strode over, snatched off my glasses, broke my nose, and had me ejected. So that when my child did come on, I wasn't there. And she took it as a personal affront. She developed an immediate Oedipus complex. And she's now living in sin in North Cornwall with an unemployed rifle range attendant. So I think it can be said more truly of me, even, than it can be said of Coriolanus. He shall have a snowball memory.
Poor Dennis, I do hope somebody will make up for it to him next Christmas. And now back to Frank Muir and his quotation. Has anybody here seen Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y?
Ah, yes. Actually, mine is more in the nature of an appeal because of my ferret. You see, I don't know if you know, I don't know if you've listened to this program before, but I invent things quite a lot in my spare time. And I was in the process of inventing a two-holed nose flute. Because although the Javanese nose flute is quite well known, it's a lonely instrument to play. And it occurred to me there must be a felt want of some length or other for a nose flute on which close friends could play duets. Well, I was experimenting one day with this length of wood with holes in it, applying it to my nose and snorting outwards, and it made no sound at all. I blew and blew. I could never get any sound. Then one day while I was blowing, a ferret suddenly turned up. Lovely little brown ferret, little curly things, just under his chin, little curly pieces. I used to call him Curly Chops. And every time I blew my nose flute, no sound, but my little ferret turned up. And I realized that quite by chance, by this strange quirk of fate, I had invented a noiseless ferret whistle. That now the world could always summon ferrets when they wanted to, noiselessly, as with noiseless dog whistles. Noiseless ferret whistles. So I applied to the patent office, and I wrote to them and said I'd invented this noiseless ferret whistle. And could I have a patent? And they wrote back, well, they didn't write, actually, it was a sort of form letter printed, saying that they will send for me for an interview. In the meantime, would I lock away my invention and keep the key in a safe place? So, I bought a little safe and had it let into the wall, and I put my ferret whistle, noiseless, in the safe, and I locked it very carefully with a key. And it said, put the key in a safe place. Well, that made me think a bit. And I had a bright idea. You know those old Japan cash boxes one used to have? I bought one of those from an army surplus store, and I put the safe key in that, and I locked the cash box. And I had this key. You see, now I thought, I must keep this key in a safe place. Surely a combination lock is the thing. So I rushed out, and I bought a combination, a briefcase, you can buy them now, with combination locks. And I put the key of the cash box in the combination lock of the briefcase, twisted it round so nobody would know. But of course they give you a little card with the combination lock on, with the lock of the combination on it. There I was with the card of the combination lock. And I realised that I had to put this in a safe place. And I remember that railway stations have safe deposit boxes. So I went to Liverpool Street Station, and I hired, only cost half a crown, and I hired this lovely big steel strong thing, and I put the combination in that, and I locked the thing, and I took the key away. And I had a key in my hand. Then I had a bright idea. Surely the thing to do, if one wants to keep a key really safe, is to put it in a safe. So I bought a safe, and I had it let into the wall, and I put the key in that, and I locked it up, absolutely safe and sound, and I had the safe key. And I felt a little funny movement in my pocket, and it was Curly Chops, my ferret, whom I always used to walk around with me during the daytime, and I used to set him off, and used to go off into the woods, or over he went. And I thought, now here's a thing. If I get a bit of ribbon and tie the key of the safe round the ferret's neck, I can summons him any time I want. So I did this, and I sent Curly Chops off into the woods. And, days and days passed, about 2 weeks passed, and yesterday morning I had this letter from the patent office asking me to come along tomorrow morning at 9:30 off the clock with my noiseless ferret whistle. So I didn't forget. I knew where it was. Now, wait a minute. It's in the first safe. And the key of that is in the cash box. The key of the cash box is in the briefcase of the combination lock. The secret of the combination is in Liverpool Street Station, lift luggage, lock up. The key of that is in the safe. All I've got to do is open the second safe, and the key of that is around the on the ferret's neck. On the other hand, to get the ferret, I'd been hoisted on my own vicious circle. The boot was now a horse of another colour, in fact. No iron bars, a cage. And the only way I can get my invention to the patent office by tomorrow morning is to get little Curly back. So I don't know where he is. I can't get at the whistle. If I can get at the whistle, I can get him. And I've got to get to him before I can get to the whistle. The only hope that somebody might have seen him. He's brown. He's about 9 inches long. I've got to ask everybody before tomorrow morning. I'd like to start with the studio audience, please. Has anybody here seen Curly? C-U-R-L-Y.
That's definitely the saddest story. And it leads to a result in which Dennis Norden, nevertheless, wins the contest of the two stories. But as far as the contest of my word as a whole is concerned, this is won by Dillis Powell and Frank Muir. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.